Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, calling on pediatricians to be more aware of teen depression. New guidelines are out from the American Academy of Pediatrics on recognizing depression and other mental health conditions in adolescents. The guidelines were created to help doctors ask the right questions of kids 12 and up and encourage close observation. Now, Minnesota, by the way, is ahead of the game. In 2017, 73% of kids between 12 and 18 who spent time at a primary care clinic were screened for depression. Even so, too many doctors are missing the signs of treatable mental illness. So as we talk about how to recognize depression in teens, I think your family experience would be really valuable to the conversation today. Is there a teenager in your family who's dealing with or who may have a mental illness? And has your family doctor been helpful with that? And if you're a physician yourself who works with adolescents, how do you handle this? So I'd like to hear your family experience. If there's someone under the age of 18 in your family who's dealing with a mental illness, particularly perhaps depression, whether the family doctor has been helpful. And doctors, I'd love to hear from you this morning. If you work with adolescents, how do you handle this? Are you observing by asking specific questions? Are you finding that it's hard to get the kids to open up to you? So your experience valuable to the discussion too. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can talk to me about it on Twitter. It's at CarrieMPR. Dr. Laura Richardson is with us. She's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine at Seattle's Children's Hospital, and she's with us today from Seattle. And Laura, welcome. Our first name's okay with you?
Yes, that's great.
Laura, welcome. Really good to have you on the show. And Dr. Gregory Plemons is with us, Associate Professor of Clinical Pediatrics at Vanderbilt University and with us today from Nashville. And Gregory, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Laura, to zero in for a minute on depression, does depression in an adolescent look different than it does in an adult?
I think sometimes it can, mainly in that adolescents tend to be a little bit more irritable, and sometimes I think it's a little bit harder for them to put into words what they're feeling, and it's a new experience to them. So I think that it can look a little bit different, but many of the symptoms are similar.
Yeah, I noticed that you brought up the irritability part of this first, Laura, and I think we expect teens to be, a little difficult, a little irritable anyway. How do you separate what might be a manifestation of depression from just the average mood swings that you see in a teen, especially when it comes to irritability?
Yeah, I think you have to be really tuned in to your child and notice if they're doing things differently. So one of the things about depression is that it's not just that kids can be a little irritable, which they commonly are with their parents. It's really that they're starting to withdraw more from their friends, or they're not seeming to enjoy things that they enjoyed before. So I think it's really looking at the whole pattern of how it's fitting into their lives and how they're functioning. And then asking really good questions about how they're feeling.
Gregory, I was reading something that a Chicago pediatrician said about this. He said this inability to experience pleasure as a teen is what he called a hallmark that separates teen moodiness from depression. Could you expand on that? What does that really mean to you?
Well, I think, certainly it can be hard to, I think, sort out what's sort of normal teenage behavior and angst and worry about certain things, and what's real depression. And so I think the other thing that I tell families to focus on is, it really is a biological kind of process, too. So if there are changes in sleep, if there are changes in eating habits, eating too much or eating too little. I mean, all of those things can kind of be warning signs. So I think, typically teenagers still enjoy things, right? I mean, they still enjoy their music, they still enjoy their friends, they still enjoy, those kinds of things that we associate with with adolescents. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, families, like the other doctor said, I mean, really being tuned into your teen, I think, is very important, you know, to notice. And there are lots of adjustments that occur with certain things, but really kind of looking, you know, not only day to day, but week to week at what's going on with a child, I think can be really important.
So I want to make sure I understand how you've responded to that, Gregory. You're saying that may not, this seeing your teen not take pleasure in music or a special meal or something like that, may not necessarily be one of the symptoms that you would point to as a key hallmark.
Right. I mean, I think you have to be careful. I mean, lots of things kind of, teenagers have lots of mood swings and certainly, you know, I think they can lose interest in things and they can like one band, you know, one week and something the next, but I think kind of overall kind of, patterns that you see are really important. So, I mean, I think if they've definitely used to be engaged in a hobby or a sport and they've completely lost interest in that, isolation is, I think, one of the really early hallmarks that we really need to be tuned in. If they're isolating themselves from their friends or their peers, I think that can be definitely a red flag, too.
Let me grab a call here from Anthony in Rochester. Hi, Anthony. It sounds like you work with adolescents. Is that right?
Correct.
And what's your observation when it comes to teen depression?
Well, as the last gentleman said, you know, they tend to isolate a lot more, and it's hard to motivate them to kind of do anything with, like, you know, we work on coping skills and other things, and it's just finding the motivation for them. And with severe depression, it's lacking the motivation to even do those simple things. So how do we incorporate medications and other therapies and engagement to help them kind of recognize this is a normal thing?
Yeah, Anthony, hey, I'm sorry your phone's cutting out, but Laura, I think he was speaking to this idea that it requires close observation to determine what is normal adolescent behavior and what are signs of depression. What else can you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the few things that I would call out are, and the things I hear from kids all the time is that they're not really enjoying what they used to, or they just can't motivate themselves to do something they know they should.
Mm-hmm.
They know it might make them feel better, but they just don't do it. And when we're treating teens, usually we ask them, you know, what things, if treatment works, what would that look like for you? And one of the most common things I hear is, I would feel like I'd want to do things, or I'd want to go out of the house, or I'd want to, you know, like, it, I wouldn't get so frustrated with everybody, is the other big one. So I think that what the caller said really continues to point to looking for changes in behavior in your child, and then checking in with them on how they're feeling, and with motivation and lack of wanting to do things as a really key one, along with many other symptoms.
So that's interesting. So when you're treating adolescents, you're saying you can see the other side of this, right? You try to get them involved in imagining what a better outlook or a good treatment outcome would look like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think when we are trying to distinguish depression from moodiness, one of the things that I really focus on is, how is this affecting your life? How is it affecting your day-to-day function? And, you know, with treatment, you know, I have these standard things that I'm monitoring for, but what I really want to know is, if you're going to join in treatment at this time, what would success look like to you?
That's
and
good.
What would it look like to feel better? So we usually ask that of all the kids before we start some form of treatment. So then we check in with them. How are we doing on that? So that they know what they're looking for to feel better as well.
Let me grab a call here from Dr. Michelle Sherman in Minneapolis. Hi, Dr. Sherman. You work in family medicine, is that right?
Yes. Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Yes, thank you. I'm a clinical psychologist working at Broadway Family Medicine, University of Minnesota North Memorial Clinic. And just wanted to add that I'll certainly appreciate and celebrate the importance of pediatricians assessing and regularly providing resources for teens. I'd actually like to think about it a little more broadly, and that we here in family medicine start screening everybody universal at age 12 and up. And so we think opening the discussion, and we do it both verbally and via a standardized questionnaire, thinking in family medicine that these are things that certainly we know are affecting young people, and how can we start to open the conversations among the families with perhaps their parents or caregivers, and then start providing resources early. So I think it's incumbent upon all of us as community members to think about this, and kind of as was being previously said, not just you know how they're doing in our offices, but getting role functioning, how they're doing in school, how they're doing in hobbies, how they're doing in sports and whatever else, because teenagers can be a handful. They can be hard to deal with at home and things, but
Michelle,
how are they doing in other domains?
I'm not sure that I understand what you're asking for here, though. Are you saying that if as a teacher you interact with students, you ought to be on the lookout here, too, and you should, you know, have some knowledge about how to screen for this, or what?
Most definitely, yes. I was actually specifically referring to that I think it's important not only for pediatricians, but for other primary care doctors to also screen for depression is really what I was saying. But I definitely think that everyone who's working with and interacting with young people can be aware of potential signs and things, and then have that open way of communicating. Because really, when we're considering any sort of mental illness with adults or kids, we really want to look cross situation, cross time, and not an immediate response to one specific stressor. So certainly education for teachers, for people who work in churches settings, sports, all these sorts of things, being aware of warning signs for depression or anxiety or substance, I think is imperative.
Gregory, how does that sound to you? And I will tell you that I've got a tweet here from Bobby who says, you mentioned teachers having some responsibility. Please know we as a society must stop relying on government and systems to raise our children. Teachers can and do play an amazing role, but they aren't responsible. So what do you think about spreading this out further into the community?
I think definitely there needs to be increased awareness. And so I think when you're not only talking about depression and anxiety, you're also talking about suicide and those kinds of things. And we know that depression is a risk factor for suicide. So I 100% do believe that teachers ought to be able to know what to do if a student reports to them or another student reports to them that someone is suicidal. I think that, you know, that definitely is an indication to intervene and save a life. I think, you know, we're inundated with sort of doctors are complaining as much, I think, sometimes as teachers, as, you know, we have to screen for this, we have to screen for that. And mm-hmm. what evidence is there that screening makes a difference? And I think those issues do need to be examined and researched. But I think clearly part of this, I think, is really trying to continue to remove some of the stigma that surrounds mental illness, because we know that about 50% of kids are not being treated or don't seek care. And I think that was part of the whole point of the new guidelines, was that we still are missing a lot of these kids.
Dr. Renee Critchlow is on Twitter here with us. She's been on the show a number of times. She says, screening teens for depression, this is critically important. In our family medicine clinic, we start screening at age 12 and up. And I'd like to hear from you, as someone who works with adolescents in the medical field, how effective do you think the screening is? What kind of observation do you pursue to try to figure out if you're seeing the symptoms of a teen who is depressed or showing other symptoms of mental illness? And then within your family, is there a teen in your family who's dealing with some kind of mental illness, particularly depression or some other kind of mental illness? And has your family doctor been helpful with this? How did you initially observe the symptoms in your own family? What did you do about that? Was there help available? Where does the family physician fit in? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Dr. Laura Richardson with us today from Seattle Children's Hospital, and Dr. Gregory Plemons with us from Vanderbilt University. I have a question on Twitter about anxiety, Laura, and this is something that I was curious about. Brenda asks, where do anxiety disorders fit into the conversation? And I'll add, where do they intersect often with depression?
Yeah, that's a great question. We know that a lot of times that anxiety disorders actually precede depression. Anxiety disorders are more common and more prevalent than depression in kids. Often we'll see manifestations of anxiety a lot earlier. And I think what we know is that kids who have a tendency towards anxiety as they head into their teen years may subsequently develop depression. So there's a lot of overlap between those two issues. And, you know, anxiety as well, you know, anxiety is very similar to depression in that when I talk with families and kids, a lot of kids have some anxiety. Really, the question is, how is that impacting their lives? Hmm. And I think what happens with anxious kids is when it does start getting them to withdraw or do less, then that can then move on to depression. So the two are very closely interrelated.
I think I should ask you how you know you're seeing anxiety that needs to be addressed and just, you know, the average anxiety of growing up in the kind of environment that kids grow up in today. What's the difference?
Yeah, I think it really gets back to what impact it's having on that kid's life. So, you know, a lot of times what I'll do is say we all have some anxiety when it stops you from doing the things you really want to be doing, when it, causes you distress on a regular basis, that's when it gets to be an issue and an issue that we need to address. I think that the thing with anxiety is, again, anxiety exists on a spectrum. So most of us have some component of anxiety. It's probably a little protective from doing something risky. And kids who tend to have more anxiety, that the teen years are a really great time to work on some coping strategies because those feelings don't go away. And they're still in a really high learning mode. And so I often encourage families to think about, you know, having the child engage in some therapy to learn some coping strategies and ways that they're going to manage that anxiety. I think long term that can be really beneficial for kids.
Let me grab a call here from Wesley in Maplewood. Wesley, it sounds like you've been through this. Okay, let me go to Isaac in Rochester. Hi, Isaac. What's your experience with this?
Hi. First of all, as a teenager, I had depression, so I kind of understand this idea. But I was going to talk about how teachers play a very big role in this, and I kind of wanted to respond to the tweet you had from, I think his name is Bobby earlier.
Sure.
Because doctors only see students, you know, a couple times a year, whereas we see them every week, 5 days a week, 9 months out of the year. So we can pick up on the social cues a lot quicker. And it's not necessarily something that we then go hand in hand and say, all right, let's take you to the doctor, but we can refer them. And I think that's an incredibly important role as in helping them develop as young students, especially with any emotional issues that they might face.
I think, Isaac, that I was hearing from that person on Twitter about there's so much responsibility now, you know, to add this and to make us somehow responsible for maybe missing, you know, signs of depression is an additional burden. That Bobby was saying, I think, to a profession where people feel overloaded. What do you think of that?
I understand where that comes from, however, it's important for teachers to get to know their students pretty closely. Like, that is an extremely important factor in the teaching process, and as a result, I think that it's pretty common to be able to pick up on those cues. So,
Gregory, where do you come down on this?
Yeah, I think what we're really talking about here is really you have to have a sort of systematic approach. You know, I have the opportunity to interact one-on-one with students, and so if they happen to be in the hospital setting or the office setting, we can have a conversation about those things and talk about those things. On the other hand, I don't see that patient from day to day, and most adolescents do not, you know, go in for regularly scheduled sort of health care. They usually only come in when they're sick or ill. So I think a teacher, you know, just as we did with attention deficit screening and those kinds of things years ago, you know, the teacher's input is vitally important for those kinds of diagnoses. And I think that the teacher's input can be valuable because they're sort of seeing that child over time. But again, I don't want to add to the burden of of our school teachers that, you know, I think that's where, you know, a lot of times we do have, we need to be advocates for more school-based services and counseling, because I think that can sometimes bridge the gap if there's, you know, actually psychological services available or, you know, in certain places where they might not have access. I think school-based services can be very important.
Jane says on Twitter, I have a 16-year-old with depression. He's lucky to have mental health services in place right at school, and along with his pediatrician, he got quick care. It can take a month or more to get mental health appointments. Otherwise, more help is needed, especially in rural areas. And to Jim in Lake Elmo, Jim, you have kids that are going through this, yes?
Yes, they're adults now, but still dealing with one with bipolar and one with a borderline personality and anxiety, depression
and
issues.
Yeah, and where did the help come from? How did you initially spot these issues to be able to bring in some help?
With one, it was pretty obvious. At a very, very young age, there was some emotional regulation issues. So screening really was never a factor. And I think there was great support from the school. But I think what was missing early on is one, an appropriate diagnosis was difficult because it felt so often that there was intelligent guessing, if that makes sense, a real hesitation to come up with an actual diagnosis. Waiting for the child to mature. In fact, until adulthood, we were never really given a here is what the issue is. But I think the other that was really lacking, and it really took a lot of effort to try to bring into play the holistic or the whole family approach. And that, I think, for me, and believe me, we sought a lot of research and met with a lot of different professionals, and it wasn't until much later in the game, if you would, that it became more of a, you know, how does the whole family interact and support and cause, if you would, some of these issues?
Two good points there, Jim. I'm going to take them up separately. Gregory, would you come in on this idea that Jim was saying, intelligent guessing, you know, not really sure what the diagnosis was, and years are going by as the family's trying to address this? Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't want to make any comments on sort of how difficult some of these things can be to diagnose, because there are certain criteria that mental health professionals use, and we know that you know, a lot of times those are based on age, and you know, I think we walk the fine line between making that diagnosis and not labeling a person too, you know, with all the issues that come up with health insurance and stigmatizing and those kinds of things too. So I understand that point. I think it's crucial that you have really people that are trained to work with children and adolescents. I think that's another whole issue that we have as far as a shortage nationwide of people that are trained specifically in you know, child psychology and child psychiatry. But I understand his point. It certainly does take some, you know, time to sort of sort out sort of what is anxiety. Like the other doctor said, anxiety can evolve into depression, and these things are not sort of static things. They're dynamic processes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Laura, he was also saying it took too long to bring the whole family into this. How do you address that?
I think that's a challenging question. I think kind of stepping back from that, I think one common theme that has come up now in a few callers is the importance of the surrounding community and sort of supporting adults in particular. And for some kids, those are the family, and the family is able to fill that supportive role. And in some instances, it's the teachers who may have a close relationship with a kid, or a coach, or a neighbor, or a friend, and I think we can't underestimate the role of important supportive adults. I think that when kids do struggle with depression, that it impacts the entire family dynamic, and that one thing I think that's really common is it's easy for the family members, and particularly parents, to get really frustrated with what's going on. Because, again, if you think about it, that lack of motivation and your child not getting out and doing things. And commonly I'll hear parents say, why can't they just get better? Why can't they just move on? Why can't they just get over it? And so having the family involved, having them really understand what that adolescent is going through, can be crucially helpful in helping them get better. And I think even more, the caller talked about bipolar disorder. I think even more when you have more serious and recurring mental health disorders, both understanding the impact of the family, but also helping the family to kind of be able to step back and support that youth is crucial. I think the main challenge keeps coming back to where do we get that help and how to get them into family therapy and getting them into experience family therapy.
Laura, quick question on gender here. Is gender a factor where girls may be more susceptible to this, or that it looks depression looks different in girls than it does in boys, and sometimes it's overlooked because of that?
It's probably both. The research suggests that depression is more prevalent in girls. All the way through, it's more prevalent in girls, although there's a big jump for girls during puberty. It's a little bit more similar in age distribution in younger kids, and then when girls hit puberty, they have about twice the rate of depression as boys. But I also think boys are more likely to present with a more irritable presentation. I think they may be more argumentative. You know, sometimes we'll see kids where they're, you know, failing in school, they're arguing with their parents, depression isn't the first thing that jumps to mind, but really
sure.
Depression is underlying it.
Right.
So it both are true that it's probably more prevalent in girls and we don't recognize it as much in boys.
Therese says on Twitter, I was disruptive, she says, quote unquote, as a child. And it definitely was more looked on by my teachers and it set me up for depression as an older person. I think, Therese, maybe more explanation here on Twitter here for exactly what your experience was. To Vanessa in Minneapolis. Hi, Vanessa. What's your insight on this for us?
Well, hi. My experience as a depressed adolescent was that I was part of an abusive family system, and I was punished for trying to get help for myself. And I don't think a doctor would have seen what was going on. There's not enough contact. But people at school definitely probably knew, and at that time weren't really empowered to do anything about it. And I feel like, unfortunately, though we don't want to put this on teachers, we probably need a lot more experienced mental health professionals in our schools who are actually empowered to do something to help kids.
Gregory, what do you think of that?
Well, I think she brings up an excellent point. I mean, we talk about getting the family involved, but often we know that a risk factor for depression and suicide is trauma, whether that's physical
right.
abuse or sexual abuse. And so, you know, I think you have to sort of be cognizant that, that you know, there are lots of issues that can be playing into this. And I can't underestimate, you know, the role of, another adult or a person that kid confides in can be really crucial and important.
I have to say, though, Gregory and Laura, we're in a state with a good education system, but with nowhere near the number of guidance counselors that are needed in schools. I'm not sure whether, you know, saying, well, we need more people who have this kind of training in schools actually means anything happens with this. Do you know what I'm suggesting here, Gregory? I mean, where's the money come from for that?
That's a good question. I mean, I work on the hospital side of things, and I know that we are spending, you know, millions of dollars every year on adolescents in crisis mode. And I think certainly studying, you know, more what is the evidence, cost effectiveness of prevention and getting kids plugged in early so that we don't see, you know, more costs down the road. I think that can be really important. I don't know where the money comes from. That's a big debate. But we know that you know, mental health has not been traditionally funded by insurance companies. In fact, that's been a big debate over, you know, parity between mental health and other, you know, chronic medical conditions. I don't know where the money comes from, but I think we definitely need more support.
Hmm. Discussion here, if you've just tuned in, about recognizing depression, in adolescence and these guidelines that the American Academy of Pediatrics has come out with on recognizing depression and other mental health conditions in adolescence. Dr. Laura Richardson with us from Seattle Children's Hospital and Dr. Gregory Plemons with us from Vanderbilt University. Alan says on Twitter, I'm a mental health worker in a school, and the biggest challenges to children receiving services is insurance and lack of providers. Some districts don't believe children with mental health issues belong in mainstream classes. Laura, is that something that you've encountered in Seattle?
Yeah, I think that part of why we struggle so much with mental health issues is really a shortage of providers in all sectors. So it's the schools, it's the community. A lot of it from the healthcare realm has to do with this historic and hopefully changing a differential of how insurance companies would pay for mental health versus physical health. And I think, again, I think there's some strong voices and we're making progress on that. And we're making progress on recognizing that there's no mental health and physical health, that it's really all one health. So I'm hopeful that there more changes are going to keep coming. And there's a lot of people working on this. But I do think that accessing providers is really the biggest challenge that you're probably going to hear from all these sectors.
You know, I think what you just said about One Health is really powerful. Do enough people believe that yet?
I think we're making a headway. And I used to run a program for kids with chronic pain, and I would get kids where they'd be sent to me and the provider would say to them, well, it's all in your head. And I would always make the point that nothing's all in your head and nothing's all in your body, that if you have a chronic illness, it affects the way you feel. And if you have, if you have depression, it affects the way your body functions and feels. And so when we separate these two systems in our healthcare system, in the way we treat people, we do people a disservice, and we I think we miss the boat. I feel like there's growing recognition, at least in the medical field, of the importance of behavioral health in the care that we provide and having mental health providers as partners. I feel like we still have a long way to go, though, in making sure that that type of care is accessible for all.
Call here from Susan in Rochester. Hi, Susan. Sounds like you're going through this at the moment. What's happening?
Yes, we are. Can you hear me?
I can.
Here is the situation that we have. My daughter has a biracial son. He began having difficulties really at age 10.
Mm-hmm.
And we have tried everything to help this child. And first of all, the diagnostics were very difficult. And, you know, we have a therapist who has stuck with him for 3 years. There was difficulty in diagnosis. It has been that he has depression and also severe anxiety.
Uh-huh.
But the difference in the treatment, we have another family member whose son, same age, white, and I'm not trying to make this a racial issue, but one of the therapists told my daughter, you know, when he acts out, and he would act out very aggressively sometimes, you need to call the police and they need to take him to a juvenile center or jail.
Mm.
The other family member whose son is white was told that he needed to go to hospital and, receive treatment for his aggressive behavior.
So, Susan, stay with me here, and I'll turn to Gregory and Laura about whether there is a racial component here. Gregory, is there, to the way that depression and anxiety may be observed?
Well, certainly. I think we all, as physicians, struggle with our own inherent bias, and so I think certainly gender and race do play into anxiety and depression. And I think, you know, obviously the more disruptive behaviors, I think oftentimes get the more attention. And certainly we know that, you know, arresting a juvenile or placing them in detention or those kinds of things are not going to make, if there is a diagnosis of anxiety, depression, they need to get help for that first and foremost.
So, I mean, I think there certainly are instances in which race has unfortunately, you know, played a role. And I think, I think we're still trying to sort of recognize all the cultural differences and those kinds of things that play into these disorders.
Yeah, Laura, you know, the concerning thing is from Susan's description here is that you get a kid that age into the juvenile system, and we know where that can often lead, right? Once you're into the juvenile system, you're not getting the attention for the mental health issues that you need, and perhaps you're developing some kind of a record, and that follows you through the rest of adolescence and perhaps into your later teens and 20s.
Yeah, I think that there are some systemic biases and systemic racism in the way that we treat behavioral symptoms in kids. And, you know, I think getting into the juvenile detention system or getting into, you know, a correctional facility is certainly an extreme manifestation of that. I think we even see it in the way schools respond sometimes, you know, to kids' behavior and these kind of inherent biases of what they attribute a kid's behavior to be due to.
Right.
And I think these are all issues that we have to address at all levels and all systems. And again, part of it relates back to how, you know, what are the resources we have to help families when kids are really struggling like this? And could we build a deeper system that doesn't involve having to call the police or involving a correctional facility? And I think those are discussions we need to have as a society of how we support these families that are struggling and these kids who are struggling.
Susan, by the way, are you still there on the phone line?
Yes, I
okay,
am.
Okay.
Yes,
so
I am.
Does any
Thank
of that
you.
Sound helpful, or what's the next step for this kid?
Well, you know, he is at a school now that my daughter found. And by the way, you know, she is a good researcher. We have just struggled with this. And it's really difficult because, you know, I'm short and he's taller than I am now and he's 12.
Mm.
And she has never called the police because, frankly, he's taller, you know, for his age. And we're very frightened
of
by
course.
What the Minneapolis Police Department would do, frankly.
Well, you just don't know what would happen in an encounter like that. And I'm sure you're concerned about, as I said, getting him into some kind of correction system. Have you turned to the therapist for some additional help?
You know, he has the best therapist
in the
world. She has worked with him for 3 years now. And, you know, a shout out to Dr. Pitterly, but at Children's. But, you know, he still struggles, and we struggle to try our best to help him. My daughter, because of his needs, lost her job. She lost her insurance. We help them, you know, financially as they're struggling. And with his needs, it's been very difficult. And there are smaller children, you know, in the home as well.
Right. Susan,
so
let me say this, because forgive me, we do have a lot of people on the line. And I will say this, I don't know how helpful we've been, but I really appreciate you raising some of the questions that needed to be discussed in the conversation. And I'm going to share this as well. Liz is on Twitter. She says, a good time to highlight that crisis connection, which answers the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, needs funding. There's proposed bills in the House and Senate, but there are some crisis lines as well for people who with their families have kids that are in crisis. Call here from Kate in Owatonna. Hi, Kate. Are you also involved with this?
You know, it has improved. Our situation happened about 5 or 6 years ago, and as Laura actually just alluded to a bit ago, things are getting better, but there needs to be improvement. In our case, our 18-year-old son went to college and was incredibly successful all through high school, also at college, was very involved, got good grades, was walking from the East Bank to the West Bank, and wanted to jump off the bridge.
that, I mean, just out of nowhere said the world was going to be better off without me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. And he, thank goodness, went back to his dorm room, told his friends, another bunch of freshmen, who immediately hauled him over to the emergency room and said, our friend is in trouble.
Oh, good. But,
I know. And the doc saw him, and of course it was just an emergency room doctor who asked probably lots of good questions. My son, again, very high-functioning, very successful, answered them all honestly. The doctor never asked him if he felt like killing himself. And because he didn't ask the right questions, essentially, he dismissed my son. He said, you know what, just hang in there, buddy. And my son walked back out to the waiting room, and his friends went, nope, that's not accessible. And but for those 18-year-old kids, my son may never have gotten help he needed. And they essentially walked back in and said, he's not telling you everything. Please ask him these things. And, of course, when the right questions are asked, it's much easier to get to the solution.
Yeah, Kate, you've raised a really good question that I want to ask Laura about. Laura, do ER doctors need the kind of knowledge that we've been talking about this morning? Maybe don't have as much awareness around this as they should.
Yeah, I think they it's interesting. In Washington state, we've recently had state legislation passed that requires that all physicians have 6 hours of training in suicide prevention.
I see.
And it's mandated as part of our CME licensure requirements, so that everyone needs to complete that training. And I think it is that recognition that all providers, and I think this blends out into therapists, school teachers, adults in the community. We should all know how to ask the question. Studies show that asking people if they're suicidal does not increase their risk for suicidality.
Mm-hmm.
But we should all ask and help make sure people get the care that they need. So, yes, I think all these providers do need training, especially on recognizing when someone needs immediate help, which is part of how we're all trained medically, you know, is to kind of triage and recognize when does someone need immediate help, and then what are the resources that I can get to help them when they really need that help. I do want to distinguish that from screening, though.
Okay, so, good. Go ahead.
So I think, you know, the guidelines recommend primary care providers screen, pediatricians screen. And I don't think that, you know, I think the question came up early with teachers about, you know, do we add more to the plate? I don't think we want everybody screening, but I do think we want everybody prepared to help and to ask the right questions to recognize when someone needs help.
Gregory, do you think some physicians feel out of their depth with this, with, you know, understanding maybe an adolescent that's in crisis in the moment or a larger issue on depression? Yeah,
absolutely. I think, I think the whole point of mind body, I think, still is lost on that sort of division starts very early. I'm right now work with medical students and I work with residents and,
mm-hmm.
And you know, my pediatrician trainees are saying, I didn't go to medical school to learn how to take care of behavioral health. And so there's still a
are they saying that? Huh. What's your answer back to them?
And a stigma around that. But the bottom line is we have a shortage of mental health professionals. And so primary care physicians have a crucial role now, I think. We've certainly seen that in family medicine and treatment of depression and adults and things like that. So I think part of it is really educating our trainees and our younger people coming along, and that takes time. I mean, education, I feel like, is one of the slowest sort of process to change in medicine. And so I think
that's discouraging, and I guess somewhat encouraging that it sounds like the change is happening. What do you say back to these students that say, I didn't get into this to focus on behavioral health?
Well, I think, you know, I think I've been in medicine long enough to tell them that medicine is always a moving target, and the things that we thought we could treat 20 years ago, you know, you really don't really need to know how to treat measles now. And so most of the diseases, the chronic diseases and things that we're seeing in children and adolescents are not the diseases that our parents saw or our grandparents saw. And so I think part of the guidelines, I think, that came out with the depression screen is trying to improve toolkits and sort of resources for family practice physicians and pediatricians to have at their you know disposal to kind of do a better job, you know, and hopefully that also increases more advocacy for well, if I screen for this now, where do I start with treatment? Where can I refer? If there's someone to refer, what can I do in the interim? Or obviously, you know, when do I need to refer for help immediately?
Yeah. Gregory, Laura, thank you so much for the time. I felt like we got a lot of good information out, and we heard from a lot of callers who were in the midst of this, and you provided some good advice. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura Richardson with us from Seattle Children's Hospital. Gregory Plemons with us from Vanderbilt University. Noah says on Twitter, I'm a 20-year-old from South Minneapolis who has depression and anxiety. I was lucky to have a mother who was able to recognize the signs of anxiety and depression and get help for me because she had the same symptoms at my age. It was in my genetics. And I want to grab a call here from Cindy in St. Paul. Hi, Cindy. Didn't want to miss what you have to say here, but I'll ask you to make it a little brief if you can.
Sure. Thank you. My daughter has anxiety and depression that was identified by us and by her teacher as early as when she was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's been going well with a therapist and a psychiatrist for the last 7 years or so. The retirement of her psychiatrist triggered some real issues for us, and we found the 7-month wait in the St. Paul area for somebody inside our network, outside our network, didn't matter. To put some context around the shortage, the only choice we ended up with, really, after talking with a couple of professionals in the area, is the emergency room, and that was just for a medication change.
Wow.
So an adult mental health emergency situation is not what she needed and was quite scary.
Yeah.
But we did get great help, and we did get access to a psychiatrist. Screening's great.
Cindy, when you said the 7-month wait, that was to get into a new counselor or a new psychiatrist?
Yes.
Wow.
Someone under 18.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And the screening is wonderful, but once you find out you need the care, that's where the gap is, we found.
I really appreciate the call and the insight on that, Cindy. And apologies. I know a lot of you have waited on the phone lines for some time that we couldn't get to you. I promise we will revisit the conversation. Coming up tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, I talk with Laura James. Her new book is called Odd Girl Out. It's about living and working and loving and building a career with autism. One of the best memoirs about what it is to live with autism. If you miss it, if you can't listen to it tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, there's always the podcast for all of my conversations. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.